won't stop. We won't stop.
We can't stop.
We won't stop.
We won't stop.
We can't stop.
We won't stop.
We can't stop.
We won't stop.
Oh, yeah,
we can't stop.
We won't stop.
We can't stop.
We marching.
We marching.
To justice.
To justice.
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 Our brothers.
With our brothers.
We marching.
We marching.
To justice.
To justice.
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 With our brothers.
With our brothers.
We marching.
We marching.
They say Jasiriak, you preach too much. I'm like, black people, we asleep too much. A black president, but he doesn't speak for us. Another black body lynch is not unique to us. Meanwhile, Kanye's rocking Confederate flags. Jay-Z and Barney's going half on sweaters and bags. It's not their fault. It's ours. All we measure is swag. They getting money. What's better than cash forever and last? Riding in Berettas and Jags, but don't crash. If you do any help, don't ask. Cause all Renisha got was a shotgun blast. Just for knocking on the door, left rotting on the floor, half a face gone. But no one was locked up like Akon. Black life comes with no insurance like State Farm. Race wrong, black people, better put your brakes on. End up on that strange porch, end up as a stained corpse. Different city, same sport. It's not an accident if you hit the witness you aim for. Bullets left a face tore, victim of a race war. Make your brother hate more. Show up at that same door, let that 38 roar. What will be my fate, Lord? Death from an officer? Who I ran to thinking that help he would offer up. 10 shots to the chest stretched. Now they talking up. Another black man looking fresh and they coughing off. Beat into my ribs crack. Rolled up in the gym mat. Blood on my kicks match. Police say I did that. No crime. The kid's black. Case closed. Casket shut. But take his organs. Fill it with newspaper and patch him up. Now tell me if that BS is matching up. I know we just want to see a twerk it then back it up. But that's what happens when we make our rappers leaders. And our most intelligent just want to be on TV featured. And they give reality TV shows to preachers. And we think activism is Facebooking and tweeting. 12 years a slave, we still fighting for freedom. Just look at the headlines, seeing is believing. Strange fruit, but now they cock it, aim, shoot, yeah. Strange fruit, but now they cock it, aim, shoot, yeah. Strange fruit, but now they cock it, aim, shoot, yeah. The end result is just another slain youth, yeah. Renisha McBride, she got a name too. And Jonathan Ferrell, he got a name too. And Kendrick Johnson, he got a name too. Ayanna Jones, yeah, she got a name too. And Michael Brown, yeah, he got a name too. I pray to God that we'll never name you.
During a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, Code Pink protesters attempted to perform a citizen's arrest of former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, holding handcuffs and large signs that read, Kissinger, war criminal, and arrest Kissinger for war crime.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine. $15 an hour, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Welcome to the third and final hour of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, WPFW's year-end special on social justice activism here in the nation's capital. Throughout the program, we've been hearing sounds and voices from the year, actions, people that we've covered right here in the DMV. I'm Esther Rivera. I'm joined by fellow WPFW hosts, Nefa Freeman and Jennifer Bryant, and Kalechi Egwin, Executive Director of Appeal. Staying with us via Skype is author and activist Gerald Horn. Thanks for staying with us, Gerald. And joining us in the studio is Barbara Arnwine, civil rights leader. Barbara Arnwine launched Igniting Change with Barbara Arnwine in March of this year on Radio 1's WOL station right here in D.C. During her hour-long show, she endeavors to engage, challenge, and equip her audience as activists in realizing a more just and equal society. After serving as president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Barbara founded a new organization this year, the Transformative Justice Coalition, and launched that radio show we just mentioned. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
So, this segment is about strategies for 2016, and we're ending this year, 2015, with no indictment in the case of Sandra Bland so far, and we also just found out there will be no indictment in the case of Tamir Rice being killed by Cleveland police. And since it's still breaking and kind of fresh, I wanted to get your reaction to that news first and how these developments shape your thinking and agenda for next year.
Well, you know, I'm so glad. First of all, thank you for having me on the show. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be on. And I'm so glad you're covering all of these great issues. It's important for people to understand that what we are seeing in this epidemic, this crisis of police killings, is not new. What's new is that the people have a mechanism for sharing this information now, that people are able to videotape what's going on, they're able to use their smartphone cameras, and they're able to upload these videos onto social media. And because you have Black Twitter, because you have outlets, people are now able to spread the word. What is tragic is that as Black Lives Matters and other organizations have come into power, is that the response by the police has not been, and I can probably should say predictably, has not been one of let's reform our practices. It's been the double down. And so what they are doing is being more defensive, more protective of each other. And what we just saw in the Tamir Rice case was not only really reckless and absolutely unprofessional policing that resulted in this young 12-year-old boy's death, but it also, we saw this prosecutorial misconduct. I have just posted onto Twitter an article that I wrote about prosecutorial misconduct throughout the country in these police slaying cases and recommending 8 things that need to happen to stop it.
Can you summarize the important point you made?
Well, one point obviously is that you can't just give these cases to prosecutors. They're too close to the police. They have a pro-police bias, but more importantly, they have a police dependency. And that means that they need police to help them prove their cases. They need their cooperation. So they're going to always have a tendency to be reluctant to bring an indictment, and they're going to also try to prove their muscle or try to prove their loyalty to the police by not, even when they convene a grand jury, not really seeking an indictment. We know in the Sandra Bland case that this happened, that one of the, quote, independent prosecutors said that he never believed that there was a case against anyone. and that he just, you know, had, he decided to have a grand jury anyway, just so that people would say that there was some kind of a process. But he never believed that there would be an indictment and didn't seek one. So we need to understand that. And in the Tamir Rice case, you had, you know, incredible police misconduct. Prosecutorial misconduct. So here's what I say. One is that instead of having these prosecutors involved, that you need to create panels that have citizens on them and legal experts that just do nothing but investigate these kind of cases. And that that's all they do, and that they are independent and they're beholden to no one. And it doesn't matter how they come out on these cases as long as they are making a fair determination. The second thing I say is that you need to make sure that the investigation itself is done by an independent person. Too much of the information that you see in these cases come from the police themselves. That's what we're watching in Baltimore right now, is that most of the investigation was done by police. Also, I say that what we need is to make sure that there are laws and rules that tell the police that as soon as there's a shooting, the police officer who's involved, that he must file within that day the incident report. Remember, Officer Wilson practically never filed an incident report in the shooting of Michael Brown.
Right.
And in Maryland and Illinois and other states, you have what are called police officer bill of rights.
Exactly.
That allow police officers 10 days before they have to file an incident report.
Well, I know that's on the agenda for a lot of groups in 2016.
Yes.
There's an active coalition,
yes,
to oppose that legislation or that law in Maryland.
Yes.
To go to Albany and...
And I'm supportive of the that coalition. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that, in addition to the incident reports, the other thing is that there should be testing for alcohol and drugs. Because a lot of these police officers, when they engage in these shootings, are literally have abused substances. Mm-hmm. And people, if you talk to people on the scene, they will tell you that they smell alcohol, mm-hmm, that they saw other kinds of abuses by the police officers, yet there's no testing. I also recommend very strongly that there's some actions that people need to take. One action is that as communities, we need to make voting for prosecutors, district attorneys, state's attorneys, attorney general a priority. Right now, most people can't tell you who their prosecutor is in their area. They have no idea. When they voted, they didn't know who they were voting for. They just voted either straight party ticket or they just voted whatever name sounded the best. You see, that's our problem, is that we allow these prosecutors to be elected and we don't have a standard. The second thing I say is that we need a standard for these, for electing these prosecutors. And that standard should be that they run on a ticket and a platform of strict police accountability. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't believe that the police are accountable, they shouldn't be in office. The best example of that, of course, is Marilyn Mosby out of Baltimore, who ran as a reform candidate, as a police reform candidate. That's mm-hmm. why the people elected her. Mm-hmm. That's why they got 6 indictments, right? You know, one of the problems is that we're not treating our vote with the care and the strategic leverage that we need to. And so those are just some of them. The other one I talk about is the need to reform and to revise the civil rights law statutes, because the civil rights law statutes right now require intent. So that's why people are always saying, where's the Department of Justice? Why aren't they involved? Why aren't they involved? Why don't they do more? Why aren't they? Because their standard, right, is what they call a mens rea standard. It's an intent standard. And that standard is too difficult to prove.
Right.
Because, you know, nobody can tell what's in somebody's mind. So what I believe is that standard needs to be changed to what is the normal standard, which is the predominance of the evidence, right? And beyond a reasonable doubt or whatever. But it would be better than what we have now, and it would allow for the Department of Justice to intervene more. So those are just some of the, you know, 8 recommendations, and I really urge people to read the article because it really talks about what went wrong in the Tamir Rice prosecution. And yes.
Okay. I think Tawanda Jones is on the line. And I know Tawanda Jones, basically for 2 years now, she has been fighting for justice for her brother, Tyrone West, who was died after being beaten, baton whipped by, I think there was one report that he was also tasered by the Baltimore Police Department. And this happened well before Freddie Gray.
Yes.
And she has actually been holding West Wednesdays every week for well more than a year. And she's going to have to leave to go to West Wednesdays starting in about 15 minutes. We want to make sure that we have her before she has to go. Good evening, Tawanda.
Good evening, sister. First of all, I want to thank you for having me on the show. And good evening to the sister that just got finished speaking and everybody that's here in the studio.
Okay, and thank you for joining us. So we're talking about strategies for 2016, and I know that you have one of the people who you have actually filed a report because the next month the UN Committee Working Group on Afro Descendants was actually going to be in our area. And you're one of the people who has filed a report about your brother's case. Can you tell, I know it's a lot and you have to go, but can you just tell listeners about what happened to your brother and basically your effort to get justice for him since his death?
Yes. Okay, thank you. And so basically my brother Tyrone West was brutally murdered right here in Baltimore City on July 18th, 2013. So for 889 days, my family has been tirelessly fighting for justice and accountability, and not just for my brother Tyrone West, but for all the victims of police brutality. So basically what happened to my brother on July 18, 2013, he basically, well, he was with, he picked me up from work, and he picked me up, me and him quickly went to go to dinner because we always spent every single second together. After he leave work, he would even come over my house and eat. Well, he would treat me to dinner, but that was just something that we enjoyed doing, spending family time. So long story short, we were at a restaurant ordering our food, and a young lady called him in need of a ride because she was stranded in a Kittmore neighborhood. So my brother, being a gentleman that he was, he basically said, sis, do you mind if I borrow your car to go pick this young lady up and drop her off? So I'm like, sure. So he was like, are you going to drive with me? I'm like, no. I said, just take me home. I'm going to finish eating my dinner, and then, you know, me and you'll finish talking. But the interesting part, before my brother got out my car, we were talking about Trayvon Martin, you know, with the not indicting when they let the officer when they let George Zimmerman just walk free. So that was just like on our hearts. That had happened that Saturday, and this is this Thursday. Me and him are conversating about it, and my brother told me, he said, sis, there's a George Zimmerman on every corner. And I'm like, brother, that's deep. Could you elaborate? And he said, sis, when I come back, I promise I'm going to tell you what I mean. So I'm like, okay. Now it's 6 o'clock, 6:30. Within a half an hour from my brother leaving me at my door front, my brother was brutally murdered. And when I say it's 7 o'clock, I'm sorry, but at 7 o'clock, I felt all type of excruciating pain, and I thought I was having a stroke. I never had one before, but I knew my whole left side of my body was in so much pain. I fell to the floor, and then the pain lasted like 10 minutes. So then after that, I quickly got up. When I got up, I'm like, oh, my God, I knew something that was going on with my brother. So with several calls, up in the hundreds, I'm steady calling him. He wasn't answering. I'm steady, freaking out. So I called my aunt, who's like a mom, to ask her, because she helped me find him. She's like, well, just be, just give it a little bit of time. You know, I'm going to call around, see if he got in the car. And then plus, I was driving. My car is a Mercedes-Benz. So anyway, long story short, he basically was in the Kentmore neighborhood. He was in the Kentmore neighborhood. So long story short, the first two officers, Nicholas Davis Chapman and Ruiz, said that they were pulling my brother over because he was driving too slow towards a stop sign, which made no sense. But anyway, these two killer cops almost killed the man in that same district, same neighborhood, two blocks over, Abdul Salam, on July 1st. they almost killed him, and they got away with that. Abdul Salam, he basically filed all these, you know, reports against these killer officers, and nobody listened to him. So my point is, they would have kept the first two, you know, on behind, like, investigated Abdul Salam's brutal beating that almost ended up to his death, which he didn't die, thank God. He had his baby in the car in his driveway two blocks over. So with that being said, my brother, after that, those two serial killer cops called like 15 more officers from, and all the witnesses told my family on the news, because we didn't know. I had to find out the hard way. At 10 o'clock on the news, sobbing witnesses were like, you know, and they said they got video footage that my brother was pulled out by his dreadlocks, called the N-word on numerous times, tased, pepper sprayed, beat to death, and then finally, after the brutal beating from one side of the street to the other, he was laying there dying and screaming Trayvon Martin. Those were his final words that witnesses said. And then he had an officer from Morgan, David Lewis from Morgan, sat on my dying brother's back, like with his knee pressing forward. Well, he had him like in a crab position, but it was kind of awkward and hard. But they said he had like his knee and his body bent, but just pushing all his weight onto my brother's that had been pepper spray taste, and he's face down, suffocating worse than the animal. Then the saddest part, nobody never even contacted my family. The only way I knew that he's driving my Mercedes-Benz, my registration, my work ID badge in the car. There was no reason that they couldn't have called me and said to Wanda Jones, something tragic happened, we need to speak to you. Or they could have showed up at my house. No one never called me. So 10 o'clock at night, my worst nightmare was confirmed. My new life began. That's when I saw my dead brother's body on the news. And then I knew it was true, and they said that he died. I heard all the sobbing witnesses. But the crazy part, and when I hear the young lady speak about the officer's bill of rights, those officers in my brother's case, they had 154 days before they even gave their statements. Mm. And it took them 154 days to even give us a partial autopsy report. And to this day, we still don't have any. Now, how do you do an autopsy with no autopsy pictures? They hit my brother body for 5 days. We weren't even allowed. They kept on saying he was a John Doe. I'm like, let me identify him, please. We had to bury him without a death certificate. And then they told me, they said, you know, we tried to get, and then we, they were like, well, send the funeral home to get his body. That was the medical examiner who made that foolishness up. But we got a leak at first that said that my brother died of positional asphyxiation, which we know to be true. That's a 300-pound man sitting on his dying back. So we know this to be true. And as soon as that statement came out by a reporter, you know, a credible reporter, then the mayor and the mayor and our outgoing state's attorney, Greg Bernstein, decides to come on and say, oh, my brother died of a heart attack exacerbated by dehydration because of the high heat. When my brother drunk a water bottle, and then God is so good that there's another water bottle on the top of my car. So we know my brother was healthy. He had just took a healthy physical 2 weeks prior to his brutal death. I was with him. I was there laughing and joking when the doctor was saying how healthy and strong he was, and I was just so happy. And so they couldn't pull us off of my family. So immediately my family pushed to the streets. We've been out here protesting. We raised our protest. Now we've been out here because the saddest part, we are more than hashtags and body bags. They think that they can just keep on brutally murdering the family. They might protest or hit the streets for like a month or two and that's it. No, you killed the wrong man, but you truly got the right family. And then when we have our West Swansea to bring the whole police accountable here in Baltimore, we were able with West Swansea, we were able to get the outgoing state's attorney, Greg Bernstein, out of office. We made sure nobody voted for him. We made sure everybody voted for Marilyn Mosley. That's how she got in the office. Because my family shut them down. You know, that's why I just want to tell people, don't never give up on your loved ones fighting. I know it's hard. And through that, I done been targeted. Fox 45 put out Allow Me a year ago, and I'm still getting my car tires getting slashed every day. My windows getting busted out. I'm getting threats. Someone will hang me from a tree. They lied to the innocent chant that I said, we won't stop. We can't stop until killer cops are in cell blocks, meaning to hold killer cops accountable. Because at the end of the day, we know all police officers don't kill people. But I'm talking about killer cops, and they changed my, they edited out, and anybody can Google Tawanda Jones, and you will see that they edited out, and they made it say, that I, it made it sound like I said killer cop, and then linked me to the two officers in New York City that got brutally murdered. From that, my life is, I almost got fired from my job. I'm a teacher. My boss was running around like, you gotta get that straight. I'm like, I'm going, you know, I would never say that. I have people in law enforcement, not only in my family, but that I work with every day. You know, their children are in my classroom. So for them to put me out there, it's disgusting, but it's not going to stop me. It's not going, I'm never going to stop. I feel like I'm the voice of police brutality, because at the end of the day, all they do is dehumanize them and make it feel like they deserve to be murdered. They're trying to pull up my brother Rucker that had nothing to do with July the 18th when he was brutally murdered.
Right.
Brutally took from us, and then they wanted to make it seem like that warranted. And then for me to see Tamera Rice, and I done met Tamera Rice. I've been like on the national level meeting all the fans. Nobody would help my family. We just been city to city, state to state, just in solidarity with all these families. And I met Tamera Rice's brother, and for him to see his baby brother picture up there, I had to turn my grieving officer and my brother picture just to console him. And then for these officers, and the saddest part is, it's always the same scenario. No officers never get indicted. They always walk free. Or even if they get indicted, they still walk free.
Okay.
And my thing is, it's about human rights. What about human rights and the human life? And I don't see, for me to see that dogs, people that killed dogs, officers that killed dogs, was charged three times in three different cases at the same time my brother was brutally murdered. But me and my family had to see that an animal's life is more than my brother's life, is more than Anthony Anderson, who was killed by the same unit. By the same unit a year before my brother. Anthony Anderson was killed in front of his mother.
Okay.
It's disgusting.
Tawana, I am so sorry. I mean, even though it's so much time has gone by, I'm just so sorry for your loss. And you know, but I don't know. I take a lot of strength from your strength that you're showing in terms of continuing to fight for your brother. And I know that we will continue to hear from you in 2016. We're taking this hour to talk about strategies for 2016. I know that West Wednesdays are going to continue. What's the intersection where you're at every?
So we're right now, we're in front of Northeast Police District. And those where 10 of the officers that brutally murdered my brother, they're still working here. Still walking the beat, but I'm just letting them know. And then the good part I love about it, because at first I lost a lot of supporters when the lie had arose, but now I'm gaining a lot of supporters back because they know that my story has never changed. I've been passionate about it because I love. I don't do things out of hatred. I do things out of love. And it's sad that the Tyrone West story never really got out there like it should have, you know, on a national level, that they pick up things when things are burning down. But I refuse to burn down anything, because at the end of the day, when you're destroying your own neighborhood and your own city, you're not getting the message apart. Now, instead of them hearing about Freddie Gray and Tyrone West, they're more focused on the daggone CVS. You understand me? That a
right,
can get
exactly.
Lost. That's
exactly.
My whole point. So
Nefer Freeman has a question for you.
Sure. Greetings, sister. I just wanted to ask you, I don't know what type of advice you might have, because this is happening to so many families. And I've been recently working with Beverly Smith, Alonzo Smith's mother, and the Smith family. And so what advice might you have? Because I know that, you know, when you're outside of the, away from the activism and away from the struggle, you're dealing with that. What advice might you have to people who have loved ones who they, you know, when no one's around, when they're, you know, they're struggling with having to deal with either depression or anything?
Yeah, so to deal with the depression, it was really helpful for me, and I had to go to a counselor immediately, and I give Roberta House, you know, and my counselor, Kim, all props and praises, because at first I wasn't going to go to it, but I knew that my life had changed forever, and I knew I needed to seek professional help. So the thing is, when they're feeling sad and down, just think of the good things. And if they start journaling in a journal, get a little journal. You can get like a little 10-cent journal or a dollar journal. Just write down those thoughts and then go back over them, and you'll see how much you grow, because you're going to grow. You're going to get past it, but the hurt never changes, but you will grow, and you will be able to accept it a little piece by piece, even though at the end of the day, you can never accept your loved one being brutally murdered. But at the end of the day, you'll be able to accept how to deal with it. You know, so to deal with, I'll just say this key. If they're into religion, pray. Pray a lot. I stay in church. I'm a Christian woman. I pray. But prayer without works is nothing. That's why my feet is on the ground. Never give up. Don't be intimidated. Be that voice for your loved ones that cannot speak anymore. Mm-hmm. You are them. That's
there you
my
go.
Advice.
Thank you. And I concur with Esther. I mean, even with both you and Ms. Smith, Beverly Smith, I get a lot of inspiration from you. Black women are just so strong. They carry us so much, and we don't acknowledge that enough.
Thank you.
Attorney Arnwine had a question for you also, Tawanda.
First of all, I want you to know that I have all the love and respect for you and your family, and this is so tragic, and I followed your story, you know, a lot, and I'm going to come out there and be with you on one of these West Wednesdays, so let's make that happen, and I will get your information from Esther, and we'll be in touch. I wanted to know, what is the date of the UN hearing? That's so important that people are aware that the United Nations is sending a delegation to Baltimore to have a hearing about all of these police killings and shootings and deaths. Can you tell people what date that's going to be?
And look, I'm so sorry because I'm not near like my paperwork where I stepped
yes,
on.
Yes, of course.
I'm so sorry. I don't want to give
them the
wrong date. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I can actually tell you that the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, they'll be in the U.S. from January the 18th through the 29th, and here in D.C., January 27th through the 29th. And they'll also be in Baltimore at some point during the trip. So we know definitely in D.C. the 27th through the 29th. And there are a lot of us who are working toward that date.
Absolutely.
And making sure that people's voices are heard.
Yes, and that we get the statements in and that people are heard. Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Jones. You are an inspiration.
Thank you,
and you are fantastic. And don't think that you're alone. You're not.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings.
Thank you, Tawanda. We are going to take a brief break right now, and we'll be right back. Oh, welcome back to Can't Stop, Won't Stop, WPFW's live year-end special on social activism here in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam, and in the studio with me is Netfer Freeman, Jennifer Bryant, my colleagues here at WPFW, and also we have Kelechi Egwin. He's the Executive Director of Appeal, and Attorney Barbara Arnwine. She's here with us in the studio, and on Skype, I think we still have, or on the line, we still have Gerald Horn, author and activist. You still there, Gerald?
Absolutely.
So I know that, you know, in a lot of conversations I've had with you in the last couple of years, you've talked about the need for African Americans to go to the United Nations to take the case of this brutality, these killings, to an international body. And I'm just wondering, because that's actually happening now. We have, I don't know if you heard the dates I was mentioning on the air, but, you know, there will be a working group from the UN here in the DMV next month. And there's a lot of us working to make sure that voices are heard during that time. But what has impressed you that this was the route to take? I'm just, some people feel that by going to the UN, for example, that we are not making enough of an effort to hold accountable local, state, and federal officials to do the right thing and to exercise the proper oversight that they should.
Well, I disagree. To the contrary, you make these officials accountable by holding their feet to the international fire. To repeat, if you look historically, slavery was abolished not only because there was an abolitionist movement in the United States of America, but because there was an international abolitionist movement that was stronger abroad than it was here. In fact, the U.S. abolitionists drew strength and sustenance from global abolitionists. Secondly, as you well know, the movement against Jim Crow was buttressed tremendously when Paul Robeson took the United States States before the United Nations, charging the United States with genocide against black Americans, and that was a major pressure point that led to domestic officials being held accountable. I'd like to compliment you in particular, Esther, for raising the F word for oh so many months, that is to say, the question of incipient fascism, because now your words are being picked up by the mainstream when they look at the Trump coalition and when they look at the right-wing populism that it exudes, when you look at the 2014 elections and the sweep that the right wing made with regard to the House and the Senate, the 2015 elections in poor state like Kentucky, where a Tea Party candidate emerged triumphant, this is very disturbing. And so we not only need to go to the United Nations in terms of limping in the battlefield, but we also need to be taking our stories, like the story you just had on a few moments ago, to RT in Moscow, to Press TV in Tehran, to Radio Havana, Cuba. We need to be sending delegations to all of those capitals. We need to not only be talking to the United Nations, but also the Organization of American States right there in Washington, D.C. We need to have international delegations at all our conventions, including and in particularly the NAACP convention in July 2016. It seems to me unless we take those steps, we'll find ourselves sinking deeper and deeper into a quagmire of despair.
Dr. Horn, I know many of our listeners, this is Jennifer Bryant, I know many of our listeners are familiar with some of the history around previous appeals to the United Nations from African Americans, but if you could speak a little bit to the historical precedent that has been set before by other folks appealing to the UN on African American issues and how effective that was.
Well, first of all, it's not only the United Nations, which came into being in 1945. Mm-hmm. You go back to Frederick Douglass, who in the 1840s was spending more time in London and in Ireland than he was in the United States of America, because he recognized that that's where the strength and power was. Recall that W.E.B. Du Bois, when he began to organize the Pan-Africanist movement, he began to take that movement abroad. The first congresses that he organized were, of course, taking place in places like Paris during the time that the Versailles Peace Conference was taking place. And likewise, with regard to the organizing of the United Nations in 1945, Du Bois was there when they had its first meetings in San Francisco in the spring of 1945, as well as representatives, I might also add, from South Africa and from colonized India. Paul Robeson, as noted, followed up in 1950, 1951, and of course the National Conference of Black Lawyers and the National Black United Front did similarly in the 1970s. I think that since the 1970s, to a degree, we've dropped the ball, and that is one of the reasons why we're in such dire straits as we speak.
Mm-hmm. And then you would essentially, well, I guess, yeah, I could definitely. And basically, we'd be going backwards if we didn't pick this up like that.
Okay, so one of the things that I wanted us to do is to talk a little bit about the pitfalls that you think that the movement can avoid. You know, already in D.C., I mean, you mentioned it, you touched on it earlier, Jennifer, when you talked about ideological differences emerging between people locally. And I know some of it's ideological. I don't know how much of it's testosterone, you know. But I want us to kind of like not leave that on the table and not touch it. What are some of the pitfalls you can think that we can avoid in terms of having kind of infighting just destroy what is a forward momentum for the movement, Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, I think that it's natural for any movement to see folks take different ideological lines, but also to employ different strategies. Hopefully and ideally, we'd all be pushing for the same end goal, but I think it's natural for any movement for folks to employ different strategies, and that's something that we've seen this year. There are some people who want to go the reform route around police reform. There are other folks who are pushing for economic self-determination, economic alternatives. There are other folks that are pushing for, you know, appealing to the UN, community control of the police. And I think all of these can be a part of a really healthy movement, yeah. And that they can all coexist peacefully together. So I think that in terms of preventing infighting, which I also think is just a natural whenever you have people doing anything, because we're people, you know, at the end of the day. I think that we should continue to study history and learn about how other folks and other, you know, manifestations of this movement in previous times have dealt with it and what they learned from it. And I think the beauty of, for example, the Black Power movement as it existed in the 1960s is that so many people wrote about it. You know, I'm reading the autobiography of Leroy Jones right now, which is by Amiri Baraka, and just seeing how self-reflective he is so informative. And I think that we should just continue to not just read these books, but read them together and talk about them together.
No, that's great. So one of the things that I've done for the program is have people talk about victories. And I guess I wanted to end the show with people talking about things that have been accomplished this year that are positive, that are forward moving the movement forward. And so you didn't get a chance to weigh in that way, Barbara. So would you like to start?
Yes. You know, I would say that one of the most important victories this year to me was the Say Her Name campaign, that people recognized that this is a movement about all of us, and that Black women and Black girls are also being slain, killed, and sexually assaulted by police. And I think the Holsclaw case absolutely one of the pivotal moments here, because what we need in this movement are victories. And one of the great victories was an all-white jury, where normally you have jury nullification almost 90% of the time, coming out with a conviction and finding this man and recommending that he be sentenced to 253 years of imprisonment. Now, people need to know that on January 20th and 21st, those are national days of action, because the sentencing of Mr. Holsclaw, Officer Holsclaw, who assaulted 13 African-American women, including a 57-year-old grandmother, 17-year-old girl on her mother's porch, and threatened these women, would go back to their homes and threaten them again and rape them again in their homes. That's how bold and vicious this man was. And it's very important for people to know that the sentencing of this criminal will occur on January the 21st. And we're asking every person on the 20th and the 21st to be vigilant, to be woke, and to, yes, and to do everything you can to tweet, to spread the word, to protest. I will be in Oklahoma City the 19th, 20th, and 21st, working with those amazing OKC Artists for Justice who have led this campaign, despite being, you know, just demonized by everybody in the city, who have done such a brilliant job. And I just think it's very, very important for us to say that we stand with the OKC 13 and that we're going to fight for their rights. And I want every Black radio station, I want every major media channel to be covering the story. Nancy Grace, she can go everywhere, camp out in Florida, go to the Caribbean, raise hell about, you know, blonde girls being killed, and say not one word, not one word about the Holsclaw case. Right. You know, this has to stop. And I think that Say Her Name was really one of the most important movements and one of the most important changes that occurred in the movement this year.
Okay, Kelechi?
Yeah, in terms of victories, it's hard for me to really pin down this within a year, because it's the fight that we're involved in is a global one. This year was the 50th anniversary of the Nguzu Saba. Nguzu Saba is the principles of Kwanzaa. You know, I think that, you know, we don't count Kwanzaa as a victory, because so many of us are still unfamiliar with it. It's still strange to so many of us. But Kwanzaa is one of the very few things to come out of the Black Power movement that continues to grow. Continues to grow every year. If you go to Kwanzaa celebrations, it's standing room only. You know, the principles of Nguzu Saba, the Umoja, unity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To strive for and maintain unity in the family, community, nation, and race. Real simple concept. The fact that we've had 50 years of these principles, Kujisagalia, self-determination, to define ourselves, name ourselves, create for ourselves, and speak for ourselves. Ujima, collective work and responsibility to build and maintain our community together and make our brothers' and sisters' problems our problems and solve them together. Ujima, cooperative economics, to build and maintain our own stores, shops, our own businesses, and profit from them together. Nia, purpose, to make our collective vocation the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness. Kuumba, to do always as much as we can in the ways that we can in order to leave our communities more beautiful and beneficial than we inherited it. Imani, to believe with all of our hearts in our people, our parents, our teachers, our leaders, and the righteousness and victory of our struggle. 50 years we've had these principles. So to the extent that we've picked them up, we've benefited from them. And folks who are hearing it for the first time probably haven't benefited from them individually. See, but what's happened is that little by little, we've managed to grow the need for these principles to operate. We need principles to operate with. It's not enough to say, don't do this. You can't keep telling people, don't do that, don't do that. You don't tell them one thing to do. The Nguzu Saba is a gift. It's a gift, regardless of where it came from. It's a gift that can empower and has empowered many, many African people worldwide. Because this is not a local thing. This is not a national thing. It started out as an African American holiday, but now it's celebrated globally. So, in terms of a victory, I think having 50 years of the Nguzu Saba, you know, is a victory for all African people. Because if we're going to talk about globalization and our struggle being global, we have to have some commonality with other African people. Where if you don't speak the same language, you don't have the same celebrations, you don't have anything unique to you and them. In other words, you celebrate what everybody else celebrates. There's nothing special between you and them. This is something special between you and them. So I think that's a major victory, this 50th anniversary.
And can I add on to that, because my family celebrates Kwanzaa. Mm-hmm. It is the third largest holiday in the world, globally. People don't realize that Kwanzaa is celebrated on almost every continent, except for those that are uninhabited.
Right.
And that is, you know, celebrated in Japan very heavily. And many other countries, people just don't realize that those principles are that powerful. But I also wanted to say two other big victories that we shouldn't forget is that this year was the first year in the international UN decade of African descendants.
Yes, yes.
That's something we fought for. We went to Durban in 2001. And fought for that, and people have been fighting for that all over the world, talking about something that unites us as African people throughout the diaspora. That is absolutely one of those principles. And it's moving to me when I go to Brazil or talk to Colombians, Afro-Colombians, or people from, you know, Africa and Europe, Euro-Africans, and all kinds of African people everywhere, that this means something to them, right? That there is a UN decade. That's something we achieved. We fought for. We made happen. Nobody gave that to us. Mm-hmm. The second one that I would also like to add is that this is the year that African American women entrepreneurs grew at an astounding rate. You know, African American women are doing everything they can to really become owners. That's why I love Ujamaa. Yes. You know, because you have to own in order to rule, right? You cannot have anything in this world if you don't own it. So, you know, God bless the child who has his own. You got to own it. You got to be able to leverage that for black employment, for, you know, for wealth and asset creation. So I am really, really proud that the women did a good job, but African-American businesses on the whole are up. Mm-hmm. And so it shows our people are rethinking this whole issue of economic empowerment and the boycott that black people did of Black Friday and this Christmas led to, we know on Black Friday, a $1 billion loss in retail sales.
That's the second year in a row.
Exactly. Thank you. So that's an accomplishment. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we could go on because we've been on it.
And I'll add one more thing to that. In addition to boycott, you've also seen a lot more networks, websites that are designed to help you find black-owned operated businesses.
That's right.
The NAACP was working on one. Buy Black 365.
Yes, millions to one. Right. I mean, there's a lot of them,
And they're popping up, and it's facilitating this empowerment. And I think that this is the principles of the Nguzu Saba inserted into the Black Lives Matter movement. In other words, that's why. Earlier, I was saying this is really a continuous process. You may change the names, but the process is continuous. You know, so in assessing it, we have to kind of look at the successes, through long term, as opposed to just within a finite period.
And I wanted to get Gerald's top, well, just some victories, some things that you might want to mention.
Well, I think that we played a role in improving the international atmosphere, which is very important to our domestic struggle, by pushing for this civilian nuclear agreement with Iran. The United States was obviously on the fast track to another war in that part of the world, which would have further opened the gates of hell. But as of 2015, at least we can say that has been postponed. Secondly, with regard to improved relations with Cuba, we all know the role that Cuba played in terms of liberation of southern Africa, particularly the defeat of apartheid during the Battle of Quito Cunavale in the summer of 1988. And the fact that now relations with Cuba are on the fast track is a very significant victory, which is feeding into another victory, which is that I think the reparations movement got a real shot in the arm when the Caribbean community, the CARICOM nations, and particularly Prime Minister Ralph Gonsalves of St. Vincent, has taken a vanguard role in pushing this movement. We all know about the role of Professor Hilary Beckles of the University of West Indies, who spoke, of course, at a major reparations conference in New York just a few weeks ago. And I think it's very important that that movement is now on the fast track, and that I think that to a certain degree, we're gaining traction on what may be the most important issue of all for our people.
Okay. Well, this has been a really great experience for me. It was a real challenge to pull it all together, but we did it. We are going to wind up here. You know, we talked about the movement for black lives, economic justice, cooperative economics, economic empowerment, the way forward in the new year. We've talked about so many things. And this has been Can't Stop, Won't Stop. And this has been a year-end special on social activism here in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Verum, and I want to thank my fellow WPFW hosts, Netfa Freeman and Jennifer Bryant, for bringing their brilliant minds and ideas and questions to the show. I want to thank all my guests for the past 3 hours, Barbara Arnwine, Gerald Horn, Kalechi Egwim, Margaret Flowers, Kevin Zeese, and Tawanda Jones. And a special thanks to our fine engineer, David Kelly, behind the glass over there. And thank you so much for listening. This show will be archived. I will make sure that it's edited all together into one piece, and I'll archive it on the website for On the Ground Show, which is ontheground.org. Okay? So raise your voice out there in the 1-6. Peace.
We can't stop. We won't stop.
We can't stop.
We won't stop.
We won't stop.
We can't stop. Yeah.